Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Peterson against McGladrey and Pullen. Mr. Tomaszewski.
May it please the court. The complaint in this case alleges that McGladrey committed accounting malpractice in auditing the funds for the years 2006 and 2007. McGladrey does not claim that its work on these audits was hindered or obstructed by its clients. Rather, McGladrey asserts something in the nature of a vested right to escape liability on the ground that Gregory Bell engaged in some type of wrongful activity, the precise nature, extent, and timing of which are matters of dispute. The district court's most fundamental error was to resolve those disputes in the context of a Rule 12b-6 motion. To be sure, there's an interesting question here as to whether the impari delicto defense can be applied against a bankruptcy trustee under Chapter 7, but this court need not reach that issue to reverse. Rather, given the procedural posture in which the case comes here, it is sufficient to observe that there are sufficient fact issues, significant fact issues, as to whether, even if the impari delicto defense did apply to a Chapter 7 trustee, the district court had a proper basis to dismiss given the Illinois court's interpretation of that defense. The district court relied on the many cases in which a firm that was a Ponzi scheme sued its auditors, making the claim, in essence, you should have told me I was a crook. But that unsympathetic case is far from what happened here. It's not clear at all that Mr. Bell was a crook during the time these audits took place. The funds were not a Ponzi scheme. They unknowingly did business with a Ponzi scheme, and if the auditors had properly done their job, they would have brought that fact to light in 2006. The facts of this case have become murky because the district court relied not only on the allegations of the complaint in this case, but also on matters outside the complaint, most notably a separate adversary complaint the trustee filed against Gregory Bell.
That was by concession, was it not?
It was by concession that the complaint could be considered. It was not by concession that the court could consider the statements in the complaint as binding admissions. There's no authority, and the authority that the district court cited does not hold that allegations in another complaint in an adversary proceeding become binding judicial admissions. In both of the cases, in the Cohen case and the Archer Group case, there were fact findings that were held to be effectively res judicata or law of the case. There was not reliance simply on allegations of a complaint. Put another way, the district court regarded...
I take it then that your position is that these are inconsistent pleadings and the trustee is entitled to make inconsistent pleadings?
Absolutely. Under Rule 8, a pleader is entitled to plead inconsistent and alternative theories. And that only makes sense in the context of a complaint, because a complaint at the early stage of a case, before there's been discovery significantly, you don't necessarily know what the facts are.
Has the proceeding launched by the other complaint now been concluded?
No. In fact, there's been no proceeding further on that at all. It's simply it's been sitting there.
I never like to hear the statement that something has just been sitting there.
Well, that's apparently...
For years, apparently.
That's apparently what's happened. There have been, I understand there have been settlement discussions ongoing. If you look at the docket, there are continual adjournments to further dates, but there have been no further proceedings. There has to be correct. There's been an answer to the complaint filed pro se by Mr. Bell. That's the only further proceeding in which he denies many of the allegations of the complaint. But clearly, Rule 8 does permit inconsistent pleadings and inconsistent pleading of inconsistent legal theories, nor does it require that they be labeled as such.
It's permitted only until one of the cases is resolved, and after that, judicial estoppel is going to carry over.
Absolutely, but neither case has been resolved in this case. Indeed, the notion that every adversary complaint in a bankruptcy proceeding is effectively incorporated into every other adversary complaint, I think, would come as a great surprise to practitioners in the bankruptcy courts. The complaint in this case alleges that the funds hired McGladrey as their outside auditor and that McGladrey told them it was not necessary to contact the vendors or the purchasers to verify that the underlying purchase and sale transactions were taking place. It also alleges in paragraph 40, perhaps the most significant paragraph in the complaint, that up to the summer of 2008, after the 2006 and 2007 audits were done, Gregory Bell believed that the fund's transactions with Thousand Lakes were legitimate and successful. The complaint also alleges that when Thousand Lakes made late payments in December of 2007, Bell requested an outside audit of Thousand Lakes and received an unqualified opinion from that auditor, a different auditor. The complaint finally alleges that the Thousand Lakes Ponzi scheme didn't become public knowledge until September 2008. Those allegations do not establish any wrongdoing by the funds or Bell during 2006 and 2007. And the district court didn't base its dismissal at all on the complaint here. But even though the Bell complaint primarily alleges that Bell was negligent in managing the funds until late February 2008, the district court used the Bell complaint as the basis for its dismissal. Now, the district court acknowledged the allegations in paragraph 40 of the complaint seemed inconsistent with the allegations of the Bell complaint. But the district court stated that the inconsistency was immaterial to its resolution of the motion to dismiss. That was error. The district court appears to have assumed that any wrongdoing by Bell was sufficient to excuse McGladrey's significant professional failure. But that's not how the Illinois courts view the in pari delicto defense. Under Illinois law, for in pari delicto to apply, there must be a causal relationship between the parties' respective wrongdoing and a determination as to the party's relative fault. So first, to the extent that Bell began his own fraud in late February 2008, the fraud began after the audit work for 2006 and 2007 was done. 2006 was long done, and 2007 was completed as of January 5, 2008. This is not a case of you didn't tell me I was a crook, because Bell was not a crook during the audit periods at issue. Whatever harm was caused by Bell's round-trip scheme, started in February, was not a cause of the prior harm resulting from the auditor's malpractice. Second, the district court avoided that problem by stating very generally that the Bell complaint alleged, quote, wrongdoing and, quote, mismanagement since 2002. The question then becomes, was the wrongdoing...
Let me take you off on a tangent, but there's something I want to be sure I understand in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Into whose shoes did the trustees step?
Well, the trustee under Section 541 took the assets of the debtor. The statement of stepping into someone's shoes is, of course, not a locution that appears anywhere in the statute. It's frequently used.
I'm aware that the investment funds don't have shoes.
No.
We don't have to worry about that.
But that's not my point.
My question was, is the trustee bringing claims on behalf of the investment funds or on behalf of the investors in the investment funds?
He's bringing claims on behalf of the funds, which were the audit client.
Okay.
But the beneficiaries of his claims
But the trustee's position is that this is a straight 541 proceeding. It is not a proceeding in which the trustee is directly representing any interests of investors.
The basis for the claim is 541. It's not 544 or 548.
Has the trustee asked any of the investors to assign their claims to him for collection? We held in Greed against Bank of New York that could be done. Was that done here?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, getting back to what the district court found, the wrongdoing that the district court referred to in the Bell complaint requires, under Illinois law, an assessment of comparative fault between the two. The Bell complaint primarily alleges that Bell was negligent. And if the claim is that both parties were negligent, then the court was required to undertake an assessment of comparative negligence under those circumstances, which is why the court should not have ignored the allegations of paragraph 40 that Bell believed the transactions to be legitimate.
In pari delicto is an absolute defense. It doesn't function like a comparative fault determination.
Well, that is actually, A, it's not true because impari delicto requires essentially a parity of fault. In other words, if one party is much more at fault
right.
than the other.
My point is that references to comparative fault determinations are inapt here. This is an equitable doctrine. The court decides it. Right?
Well, under Illinois law, which applies here, where both parties are deemed to be negligent, and this applies to accounting cases expressly under the Illinois Accountancy Act, where one party is alleged to be negligent, the negligence of the other party can be considered, but it has to be considered on a comparative basis. The fact that both parties were negligent is not an absolute bar to recovery under Illinois law, under the Accountancy Act. And that required more than simply saying that one party was negligent. Indeed, all of the cases that are cited here involve an easy enough determination that the corporation or the fund or which is alleged to have been in pari delicto was a fraud. And here, the allegations of the Bell complaint even do not allege that Bell committed fraud through 2006-2007. He was negligent. That's the allegation, but not that he committed fraud. If one party committed fraud, it's easy enough to say on the face of the complaint that they were more at fault than someone who's merely alleged to have committed negligence. But that's not the case here. This is a different case from those kinds of cases.
Well, there was at least some concurrent fraud, right?
The
time period overlaps at least in part, and Bell is accused to have participated in the fraudulent conduct for part of the relevant time period.
Well, the relevant time period for the audit closed on January 5th. That's the audit as of date of the audit. Now, the fact that the audit report was not issued until sometime later is, I believe, irrelevant because the audit work dates through January 5th. But even then, I think there's a question as to whether what work, if any, the auditors did between that time period, which has not been resolved.
Isn't the proper focus on the injury as opposed to an absolute concurrence of wrongdoing? If the injury is attributable in whole or in part to the fraud of the plaintiff, then impari delicto applies,
well,
certainly as against a claim of negligence.
The question then is what injury? Because the injury that we're not seeking recovery for any injury caused by the round trip transactions, that fraud. We're seeking injury for what occurred. We're seeking recovery for injuries that occurred before that period of time.
You're in your rebuttal time.
I see I'm in my rebuttal time. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Tomaszewski. Mr. Farina.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Stephen Farina on behalf of Appellees McGladrey & Pullen, McGladrey & Pullen Cayman, and RSM's counsel is not appearing for argument and has ceded his 2 minutes to me. I believe that was communicated to the clerk 2 days ago. It is a longstanding and fundamental principle of federal bankruptcy law that the trustee in pursuing claims on behalf of an estate, tort claims, pursuant to Section 541A, takes those claims with all defenses that would have been available had the bankrupt brought the claims itself prior to the commencement of the case. The Supreme Court articulated that principle more than 50 years ago in the Bank of Marin case. This court has articulated that principle, for example, in the Chicago Railway case. And seven courts of appeals have applied that principle to the specific context of impari delicto, the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit have all held without a single dissent in any of those decisions that for purposes of impari delicto, when Ronald Peterson brings the claims on behalf of the estates, the defense of impari delicto is to be assessed as if Ron Peterson were not here and it were the funds themselves bringing the claims pre-petition. In the Greed case, in this circuit, Judge Zagel likewise held that the impari delicto defense applies to a bankruptcy trustee. And the trustee has offered no compelling argument as to why this court should depart from that precedent settled by all of these other courts of appeals and come up with a different result. Illinois law certainly does not compel a different result. Illinois law does not have a general principle that...
Counsel, I don't think you need to worry too much about that, but I do think you need to worry about the fact that this case was dismissed on the pleadings. I don't see how one can resolve something like a pari delicto defense on the pleadings unless the culpable side falls on its sword, which doesn't seem to have happened here.
Well, two things. The impari delicto defense is routinely resolved on the pleadings in this circuit and elsewhere, and we cite some of those decisions on page 34 of our brief. Courts routinely across the country, where it is apparent from the pleadings that the impari delicto defense applies, will grant a motion to dismiss. So then, Your Honor, the question is, why is it apparent from the pleadings? It is apparent from the pleadings if one is permitted to consider the Bell pleading, the Bell complaint, and the complaint against the auditors.
But I hope you heard my question to Mr. Tomaszewski, whether that didn't count as inconsistent pleading. Rule 8 says you can plead inconsistently. What seems to have happened here is the district court said, the pleading here alleges negligence. The pleading in the other case alleges fraud. The pleading alleging fraud is binding on the trustee, pari delicto. But that seems to amount to a denial of the privilege of pleading inconsistently.
Your Honor, we do not dispute that the trustee could plead inconsistent theories. We have not relied, and the district court did not rely, on any allegation in the Bell complaint that is inconsistent or contradicted by the allegations against the auditors. If you look at the allegations, the factual allegations in the Bell complaint that are the predicate for the application of the impari delicto defense, they are not inconsistent. They are supplemental. They are allegations that the trustee chose to ignore in the claim that it brought against the auditors. But there is literally nothing inconsistent about the factual allegations that serve as the predicate for the impari delicto defense in our case. For example, the allegation that Greg Bell and the management companies committed fraud through the round-trip transactions. There's nothing inconsistent in the two pleadings. And indeed, that fact is not in dispute.
The problem is the trustee is asserting in this case that Bell didn't commit fraud but was just negligent.
Well, the label...
Perhaps you're saying there's nothing in the other pleading that's inconsistent with this one. There's certainly something in this pleading that's inconsistent with the other one.
Well, Your Honor, the label that the trustee chose to affix to its claim is negligence in the Bell complaint. The allegations are allegations of fraud. The trustee attached the plea agreement whereby Mr. Bell admitted that he committed wire fraud.
An admission of a crime in 2008. This case involves the status of the events in 2006 and 2007.
Your Honor, I believe that assertion is belied by the record and by the trustee's own complaint. The trustee's own complaint says in paragraph 35, this is the complaint against the auditors, that the audit opinions were issued in March. The complaint attaches the audit opinions. It's at the appendix, page 63. The audit opinions are dated March 28, 2008. That is more than a month after the round-trip transactions. The financial statements are dated as of January 5th. That is also apparent from the documents that are attached to the complaint. But the financial statements close, and then there is an audit. The engagement letter, which is part of the record and is in the appendix, is dated January 12th. It is signed by Mr. Bell on February 12th, and the opinion is issued on March 28th. The audit was being conducted, and it's apparent from the pleadings, the trustee's own pleadings, the audit was being conducted at the very time that Mr. Bell, on behalf of the funds, was engaging in the round-trip transactions. So there is overlap, and the overlap is evident from the face of the pleadings. Moreover, there is nothing...
I'm lost. The audit report certifies the financial statements, certifies the accuracy of the financial statements as of the very first days of 2008.
Yes, as of January 5th.
How can there be, assuming that Bell is just negligent during 2006 and 2007, how can there be a pari delicto defense for 2006 and 2007 just because by the time the 2006 and 2007 financial statements are certified, Bell has started committing felonies?
I have two responses, and Let me walk through both of them. First, the close of the fiscal period is January 5, 2008. It is subsequent to the close of the fiscal period that the audit is conducted.
I understand that, but the audit is certifying the results for 2006 and 2007. Those results could be certified as accurate even if, by then, Bell had already been convicted for a crime committed in 2008. If he started committing hatchet murders in 2008, it wouldn't suggest that anything had gone wrong in 2006 or 2007.
Your Honor, the round-trip transactions that started in February, Bell was taking money from new investors and using it to pay off old notes, notes that were on the books as of January 5th. He is paying off the notes to make it look as though the receivables that are on the books as of January 5th are good receivables. So the fraud that is conducted in February, the wire fraud, is directly relevant to the financial statements as of January 5th. Now, the second answer I have for Your Honor is that the complaint quite plainly alleges that Mr. Bell and the management companies that he controlled engaged in intentional misconduct, misrepresentations, fraudulent misrepresentations starting in 2001. Now, he chooses not to label his claim as one of intentional misrepresentation or fraud, but the actual allegations, the factual allegations, are fraud. And this court and many other courts in analogous contexts have said the label that you put on your cause of action doesn't matter. What matters is the nature of your factual allegations. For example, the requirement to satisfy 9B.
Does the complaint in this case allege Bell's scienter?
Yes, the complaint alleges, the complaint in the case against Bell alleges that Bell and the management companies.
No, I'm asking about the complaint in this case. The complaint against Bell might or might not be inconsistent. Does the complaint in this case, the complaint against the auditors, allege that Bell acted with scienter in 2006 and 2007? Because there's no fraud without intent to deceive. So is intent to deceive alleged for 2006 and 2007?
It is not specifically alleged. However, one of the core allegations of negligence that the trustee has leveled in the complaint against the auditors is that the auditors relied improperly on representations made by Mr. Bell and the management companies that turned out to be misrepresentations. And if you look at the nature of those misrepresentations, they go
look,
to...
that's the difference between negligence and fraud. That's scienter. I can make a false statement, and if the false statement was false because I didn't do enough to verify it, that's negligence. If it was false and I knew it was false, that's fraud. That's the question I'm asking. Does the complaint in this case allege fraud?
Yes, Your Honor, because of the nature of the alleged misrepresentation. The misrepresentation goes to how the transactions were structured and what Mr. Bell and the management companies were doing to monitor the investments. For example, this confidential information memoranda said that there was a lockbox arrangement whereby the retailers would pay directly in to an account, a bank account controlled by Mr. Bell. Mr. Bell did not have that arrangement set up, and he had to have known. He had to have known that that arrangement wasn't set up. So if that was a misrepresentation, and it was, and the trustee alleges that it was, it had to have been an intentional misrepresentation because he had to have known that he did not set up the transaction the way he said he had. So the nature of the misrepresentation inherently is an intentional misrepresentation, which is the claim that the trustee made against Bell, which should be considered in the context of our case. It's not inconsistent with any of the factual allegations in our case, and they should be read together. There is no requirement for temporal overlap under the law. If Mr. Bell engaged in wrongful conduct and it is imputed to the funds and it is alleged to have caused the same injury, then the impari delicto defense applies. So even putting aside the issue of when his intentional misconduct started, the law does not require there to be temporal overlap. We cite several cases for this proposition. I think it's the principle is whether or not the two parties are alleged to have caused the same injury. If you look at the two complaints, they plainly both allege that McGladrey and Bell caused the same injury. The words that are used in the two complaints are nearly identical in explaining the injury, the loss of the $1.5 billion. So there is no requirement of temporal overlap for the impari delicto defense to apply. Bell clearly engaged in wrongful conduct. There is no weighing. I am not aware of any case anywhere where a court has said where you have an allegation of intentional misconduct and an allegation of negligence, there is some weighing that is required by a fact finder to decide whether the negligence is worse than the intentional misconduct. If you have intentional misconduct and negligence, the impari delicto defense applies. That's what it was designed to apply to. So we don't think that there is any fact-finding that needed to be done. If you take the allegations of both complaints, which are not inconsistent with one another, you read them together, it bars the trustee's claim. Your Honor, one final point. In the reply brief, for the first time, the trustee advanced a new argument that was never advanced below with respect to the exculpatory clause. And the argument was that this isn't, in fact, an exculpatory clause, it's an indemnity clause. 9 times in the brief below filed by the trustee himself referred to it as an exculpatory clause. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Tomaszewski?
First of all, the timing argument with respect to the audit reports neglects to mention the fact that the 2006 audit was issued in 2007, long before the round-trip transactions took place. Second of all, the allegations of the Bell complaint, I think precisely, Your Honor, is precisely correct. There is no allegation of scienter. There's continual allegations of omission.
What do you make of this, of the allegation about the lockbox payment mechanism? Does the complaint say that Bell was telling the investors and the auditors that such a mechanism had been set up?
The offering memoranda talks about the lockbox as it talks about these other things.
Okay.
However, they were not required.
Mr. Farina says that has to be an allegation of fraud because Bell necessarily knew what he himself had or had not done.
He was not the person who set up the lockbox. The lockbox was to be set up by Petters. The issue was whether the money that went into the lockbox came from the retailers or came from Petters. And that was something that the complaint alleges that he did not inquire into, just as he did not inquire into several other things. What he got was a lot of forged and fraudulent documents. He omitted to look into any of those things further. But the allegation with respect to the lockbox is not that there was no lockbox. There was a lockbox. The issue is where was the money in the lockbox coming from? And the question then becomes, did he know that what was in the lockbox wasn't coming from Petters? The complaint wasn't coming from directly from the retailers. The complaint doesn't say anything about that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.